morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or about your own Christian life or your spiritual journey. Whether you're a Christian or not, for that matter, feel free to give me a call. We'll be glad to talk about those things that are on your mind. One of the problems is it's going to be a relatively short discussion. We only have a half hour. And we'll talk to you if you get in before the half hour is done. And right now the lines are lighting up. But there's still a chance that you can call in and get on the program today. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is going to be Art calling from Los Angeles. Art, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning, Steve. Thank you again for taking my call. My question is, there are several, but let's start with this one out here on John 17.
Yeah.
This is when Jesus, just before his ascension, and he said there that he's not going to pray for the world. That's quite interesting. Well, we are always being taught, you know, to pray for one another. But he only prayed for the ones, you know, you and, let me put it, the one that God has given him. Can you clarify and explain that? Because that gives me a kind of an impression that Jesus definitely has, you know, two sides. If you don't repent, when I don't follow him, obviously he's not going to pray for you, only for the one that my Father, you know, has chosen.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Well, yeah, the verse you're talking about is John 17:9. It says, Jesus said, I pray for them. I do not pray for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. All right, so Jesus said his prayer is for his people, and his prayer is not for the world out there. Now, of course, he's only talking about this particular prayer. Some people think that Jesus would never pray for anyone other than his disciples. And I don't have any reason to believe that's true. In fact, the Bible is very clear that that's not true. Remember, when Jesus was on the cross, he said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Now, those who were crucifying him were not his disciples, and they didn't know even who he was. They didn't know what they were doing, who it was they were killing. And yet Jesus prayed for them. He prayed for them to be forgiven. It says in Isaiah 53 that Jesus made intercession for the transgressors. So praying for the lost is not something Jesus wouldn't do. In John 17:9, where he says, I don't pray for the world, I pray for these disciples. What he's saying is, I am here in this prayer asking these things on behalf of my disciples. I'm not asking these things in this prayer on behalf of the world at large. Why? Well, he's praying that they would be one. He was praying that the church would be one and that the world would know by their unity that God had sent Jesus. Now, obviously, there is a benefit to the world he had in mind. But this was not that the world might be united outside of Christ, but rather that Christians would be united in him and that this would be a witness to the world. He also prayed that they be sanctified and that they be kept from the evil one. He didn't pray those things for the unbeliever. The unbelievers are in the lap of the evil one. John says the whole world lies in the lap of the evil one. But the disciples who had sought to escape the snares of the world and escape the snares of the devil, he prayed for them that they'd be successful, that they'd be delivered from the evil one. So the particular things Jesus prayed for in this prayer were things that were pertaining to his disciples. They weren't the things that he prayed for the whole world. But some have gone so far, I know Calvinists have used this passage to say that Jesus didn't die for all people because he wouldn't even pray for all people. He only prayed for his disciples, so he'd only die for his disciples. But that's just not paying attention. Jesus, when he was dying, actually prayed for those who crucified him, most of whom probably never became his disciples. If they did, they weren't at that time. So he didn't only pray for people who were Christians. And if we would even say, his prayer was for those who, unbeknownst to us but known only to God, would become Christians. In other words, they were the elect anyway, though they hadn't been converted yet. Well, this would not guide us at all in our prayers for people because anyone who's unconverted right now might be the elect too, for all we know. In other words, praying for the lost is something Jesus modeled. It's something Stephen modeled when he died. He said, Father, do not lay this sin to their charge. He was praying for forgiveness for those people who were killing him, one of whom was Saul of Tarsus, who became Paul. But many of them, as far as we know, never were converted. And therefore, praying for Christians is one thing. Praying for non-Christians is another thing. Paul said it's 1 Timothy chapter 2, in the beginning, he says, I exhort, first of all, that prayers and supplications and intercessions and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and all who are in authority, etc. So kings are definitely not all Christians, but he says we should pray for them. We should pray for all men. So praying for the lost is one of the things that we are still supposed to do. Now, some might say, well, because of free will, what's the point of praying for the lost? For example, I would pray for my lost friends that they would come to Christ, but can God really do that? Isn't that sort of part of their free will? Or for that matter, if they don't have free will, if it's the Calvinist scheme, why pray for them? Either they're elect or they're not. If they're not elect, my prayers are not going to help them. If they are elect, they'll be saved whether I pray for them or not. Well, I'm not a Calvinist myself, and I do believe in free will, but I believe that God, through our prayers, can exert pressure. Remember, Saul of Tarsus got saved, but it was not until God had put a great deal of pressure on him. That's why Jesus said, it's hard for you to kick against the goads. What's Jesus talking about? He's talking about the fact that there were goads goading Saul to convert, but he was resisting them, kicking against them up to that point. God was putting pressure upon his conscience. Saul was successfully, but very poorly, resisting those goads. Man can resist the pricking of the conscience, but it's difficult. It's hard for them to kick against the goads. And so we can pray that God will goad them, that God will work in their lives to give them incentives to come to him. I don't know that God really makes the final decision for them. I think there is free will, human will, in that equation. But certainly God has a lot more up his sleeve and many more resources than we see actively at work in every sinner's life at this moment. And therefore, our prayers may have a positive effect. Paul from San Diego, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Yeah.
I have a question. If you have any experience studying the Septuagint,
I sometimes look things up in it. I have the Septuagint on my shelf, and I sometimes will look up passages in the Septuagint, but I don't really use it regularly.
So you haven't done any comparisons between that and
the Masoretic text
in King James or New King James?
Well, the Septuagint does differ from the Masoretic text in some ways. The Masoretic text is the Hebrew text that most of our English Bibles use to translate the Old Testament. And so the King James and most modern translations as well have used the Masoretic text, sometimes altered a little bit by information from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is a Hebrew text to translate the Old Testament. The Septuagint, as you know, but some of our listeners may not know, is a Greek translation of the Hebrew text. And this was made hundreds of years before Christ, about 285 years before Christ. Jewish scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, decided it's time to make a Greek translation of their Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And so they did. The translation they made is called the Septuagint. Now, what's interesting is the Septuagint does differ in its wording on a number of passages from the Hebrew text. Our Bibles almost always follow the Hebrew text, though. The assumption being that the Hebrew is better. The Hebrew is original. The Septuagint is a translation, and insofar as the translation of the Septuagint does not agree fully with the Hebrew text, the assumption is the Septuagint is corrupted or is poorly translated. I mean, we do have the Hebrew, so we can read it. Why depend on a Greek translation of the Hebrew and then translate from that to English is the mentality I think most translators have. There's another way of looking at it, though, and that is, of course, that although we do have a Hebrew text, we don't have an extremely early Hebrew text. It's pretty early. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls are pretty early. But the Septuagint was translated 200 or 300 years before that. And obviously, those who translated the Septuagint were using a Hebrew text, and it was a Hebrew text older than the Hebrew text that we have, older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because if the Dead Sea Scrolls were created in the first century A.D., and the Septuagint was translated from earlier Hebrew texts 3 centuries before Christ, obviously the Hebrew text used by the Septuagint translators was an older Hebrew text. We don't have the Hebrew text from which they translated. We only have their translation. And some think that the Septuagint is a very good and accurate translation of the older Hebrew text that they had, in which case the differences that exist between the Septuagint's meaning and those of the Masoretic text which we have are flaws in the Masoretic text. That is, that the Hebrew text from the time that the Septuagint was translated from an earlier Hebrew text to the time that the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text later came along, that the Hebrew text was changed. I don't think that's very likely, though, not in a big way, because, for example, the Masoretic text dates from the 10th or 11th century A.D., and the Dead Sea Scrolls from the 1st century. So there's like 10 centuries between the Dead Sea Scrolls Hebrew text and the Masoretic text, and yet they are almost identical to each other. There are some small differences, but they're not usually differences in meaning or in sense. And that means that for 1,000 years, from the time the Dead Sea Scrolls were made till the time the Masoretic text was made, for 1,000 years, these materials were copied without significant change. And therefore, there's no reason to believe there was significant change in the previous 300 years before the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we really don't know for sure. One thing we can say is the New Testament writers did quote from the Septuagint, not exclusively, but quite a lot. The book of Hebrews quotes exclusively from the Septuagint, and many of the New Testament writers, Paul included, quotes from it at times. They did not seem to think it was, you know, so corrupted that it was worthless. And there are a few cases in the book of Hebrews where the point the writer of Hebrews is trying to make depends on the Septuagint translation and does not work well with the Hebrew text. So there is some uncertainty as to what degree we should be consulting the Septuagint. I look at it once in a while, and sometimes people point out to me, and therefore, when they do, I look it up, how different the Septuagint is on some points from the Hebrew text. But this bothers many people a lot more than it bothers me. As far as I'm concerned, the Septuagint and the Hebrew text, though they differ in some passages and some words, they tell the same story about the same God, the same redemptive history, the same saving acts of God, the same prophetic predictions about the Messiah, and so forth. And therefore, even though you're going to find some differences in some verses, you're not going to find a different message. The Septuagint, in whatever ways it may differ from the Hebrew text that we have, is really not a different Bible and doesn't have different information in it, really.
One of the things that I found interesting was that in the Septuagint, the word that's translated in our Bibles, Lord, or
is Kyrios.
Yahweh, or Jehovah, is Kurios. The Greek. And so if the synagogues, especially in the areas where Paul was going, were using the Septuagint, then their commonly used name for God, which would have been Kurios, but Paul is declaring Jesus Kurios, Lord.
That's true. It's true, yeah. So the name Yahweh in the Old Testament was constructed of Hebrew consonants, and obviously there was no way to render that name exactly in Greek, and rather than try to just find Greek letters to go along with the Hebrew letters, the translators did simply choose the word Kurios in the Greek, which means Lord, to translate the word Yahweh, and then when the New Testament was written in Greek, the word Kurios was used for Jesus. So one could argue from that, and it sounds like it's your point also, that they were saying that Jesus is Yahweh. Now, I think that's very possibly what they had in mind, although we do have to recognize that Kurios was used in the Septuagint for Yahweh, but also for in other contexts, because the word is a generic term for Lord, and there are times when human lords were also referred to that way. I appreciate your call, Paul. My lines are really full, and I don't have very much time left, but I appreciate you making those points. Let's talk to Wynn from Palos Verdes, California next. Is next in line. Wynn, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with sex before marriage. Is it a sin, or is there any biblical proof that it is a sin?
Well, sex before marriage in the Old Testament is not listed in any of the lists of sins. Adultery, of course, is not the same thing as sex before marriage. Sex with a married person or with someone you're not married to, if you're married to someone else, that is adultery. We usually call sex before marriage fornication. The word fornication in the New Testament is porneia, which is a Greek word that refers to all forms of sexual misconduct. In my opinion, that includes premarital sex as well as, you know, extramarital sex or perverted sex. I mean, incest, bestiality, homosexuality, adultery, premarital sex, I believe, are all included under the rubric of porneia, which is fornication. Now, I have to say that these other forms of perverted sex, bestiality and incest and so forth, they are often listed separately as sins in the Old Testament, whereas premarital sex is not listed separately as a sin in the Old Testament. And what we do see in the law is that if a couple were unmarried and unbetrothed and had sex, they were required to get married. So, you know, it doesn't say they committed a sin, but there is, you know, in one sense, we might say a penalty imposed upon them, especially if they didn't want to get married. That would be a penalty. So if they had to get married and they had not wanted to, that certainly is a penalty, and we'd have to say penalties are only exacted against crimes or sins. And therefore, one could deduce, I think, from that, that the Old Testament saw premarital sex as a sin. All right. We're going to talk next to, Al from Mission Viejo. Al, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, this is a generalization, so I just wanted your perspective on it. But of the tribulation, we have post, mid, and pre. Is it safe to say, because I passed this on to a Christian who asked about the tribulation, and I gave this explanation, I thought this would be a great way to get another perspective, that most evangelicals go with the pre, and a lot of the Orthodox go with the post. And so I'll hang up and take your answer off here.
Okay, Al, thanks for your call. You're referring to, of course, the rapture, although you didn't mention the rapture. Whenever we talk about pre-tribulation, post-tribulation, mid-tribulation, we're talking about the timing of the rapture. It is the rapture of the church that is spoken of as being pre-tribulational or post-tribulational or mid-tribulation. People who hold those views, to say it more exactly, is they believe in a pre-tribulation rapture of the church or a post-tribulation rapture of the church. Now, the church rapture is spoken of in 1 Thessalonians 4 and in 1 Corinthians 15. And in both cases, the tribulation is not mentioned. Neither Thessalonians or 1 Corinthians mention the tribulation in connection with the rapture at all. They just talk about the rapture happening at the coming of the Lord. The rapture, of course, is a reference to the living saints at the time of Christ's second coming, being caught up to meet him alive in the air. This, according to Paul, happens immediately after the resurrection of the dead saints. So when Jesus comes back, the dead Christians rise, and then the living Christians rise and meet them with Christ in the air as he returns. Now, there are some people who think this rapturing of the church takes place before a seven-year tribulation. You said that you're asking if you're correct in saying that most evangelicals believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, that is, that the church will be taken away before the tribulation. I think you are correct that most evangelicals these days who are, certainly dispensationalists do. And dispensationalism is an extremely popular view. It's held as the official doctrine of many denominations. For example, most Pentecostal churches, like the Assembly of God, and many Baptist churches, and many groups that don't call themselves denominations, groups like Evangelical Free or Calvary Chapel or some of those, they are officially dispensational, and they do believe in a pre-trib rapture. And insofar as many of these churches are very large, we could say a very large percentage of the Christian population in America believes in a pre-trib rapture. Now, in saying that the Orthodox churches, I think you would mean by this perhaps mainstream churches, which would mean Catholic and Greek Orthodox, but also Protestant churches like Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, you know, those kinds of churches are not usually dispensational. They don't usually believe in a pre-trib rapture. That is correct. The pre-trib rapture was rejected by all evangelicals when it was first, well, by most evangelicals, when it was first introduced in 1830. It did gain popularity, especially in America, more in America than anywhere else, really. And it's a very popular view in America. Outside America, not quite so much. And certainly before 1830, never. Before 1830, no one had heard of it. All right, let's take another call. This is from Chris in San Diego. And welcome to The Narrow Path, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about leadership and ministry. I'm part of a particular organization that an outreach group, and we have, as a leadership team for our chapter, we've talked about bringing on a individual who is married to one of our female leaders that they recently got married, and he's come from a divorce. Now, I just want to make sure, just a clear view on if the Bible does teach something clear about this, if the fact that he was part of a divorce that was not necessarily a biblical divorce, would that disqualify him from being in any kind of leadership position in a ministry?
You mentioned specifically that it was not a biblical divorce. That is, that there was no grounds, no biblical grounds for his previous divorce?
Yeah, there was no, in other words, there was no, there was no, like, marital disloyalty. No one, you know, cheated on each other.
Well, who divorced whom? Did he divorce his first wife, or did she divorce him?
I believe, I haven't actually gotten that personal with him, but I believe he left her. I'm not sure.
Okay, but that would make a difference in my mind, I think in most people's minds, because in a divorce, there is a crime committed, but both parties are not necessarily criminals. See, the crime is the crime of perjury, and, you know, that two people made a vow before witnesses, even got a government license recognizing their vow that they'd stay together for life. When somebody breaks that vow, they've committed a crime of perjury. It's just not one that the state won't prosecute it, but it's still a sin. And yet, whenever there's a crime like that, there's usually a victim and a perpetrator, like most crimes. A lot of people treat all divorced people alike. They're either easy on all of them or they're hard on all of them. But we have to realize that divorce is a crime. And, you know, there's somebody who perpetrates the divorce and the other who's usually the victim, who, especially if he didn't want it.
Yeah.
Now, if both parties wanted the divorce and agreed to it and they had no grounds, and then they're both guilty. But if his wife left him against, you know, his wishes and he was trying to be faithful, that'd be one thing. If he left her without grounds, then that's another thing. And then again, a question is, did this happen before he was a Christian? What has he done to try to make restitution if he's repented of his sin? these would be important issues. Now, some people would say that a person who's been divorced and remarried shouldn't be an elder anyway. I have divorced and remarried in my past, though I never divorced. I was against divorce. I am against divorce. I'm not in favor of it. My wife left me over my protests, and therefore I've done nothing to put myself in a divorce condition. But at the same time, I realize it's controversial, and some people think that divorce and remarriage is wrong. And so I would not make myself available for a position of eldership or church leadership like that because of that. Now, some people would feel differently. Some people actually would say, well, since you were innocent of the matter, it shouldn't disqualify you. But I'm more concerned about the testimony. I really think when a person is in church leadership, what Paul said in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus 1, when he's talking about the qualifications for church leaders, he emphasized their marriage example, that their marriage should be an example, their family should be an example. And since my previous marriage and my status as a divorced person is not a good example of what marriage is supposed to be, I would think, you know, I'll be glad to minister, but I don't think I should put myself up there as a leader in the church. Although, to tell the truth, I'm in a very good marriage now. I mean, I think my marriage now is a very good example, but that's, you know, that's not the only thing that people take into consideration. So if he is the one who is guilty of the divorce, if he has not repented of the guilt of having divorced his previous wife, if his ex-wife wants to be with him and has not cheated on him and has remained faithful to him, and he's married to somebody else, then his situation is very complicated indeed, and I would not wish for him to be an elder. In fact, one would need to maybe pursue the issues of church discipline with him. Now, if he, on the other hand, is innocent of it, or he was guilty but he's repented, he's sought to make restitution, there's no way to be reconciled, his wife has gone on, his first wife has gone on and married someone else, I would say he's quite innocent then in his present situation. But it still might be, because of the controversy that associates with divorce, it still might be desirable for him not to be a church leader. See, I don't know that the church should hold it against him, but I think he, on his own, should be sensitive to say, well, you know, my circumstance is such that I don't want to hurt the church, and therefore I think I'm going to maybe just sidestep this issue. Now, there are a lot of churches that wouldn't object to it at all, and in which case, that's fine. I would not be opposed to a man righteously divorced and remarried being a pastor or an elder or something like that. I would just be concerned about what people might say. All right, I'm sorry I'm out of time. I appreciate your calls all. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday for a half hour in the mornings. I also have an afternoon program every day that's an hour long. We are listener supported, and if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, that's what will keep us on the air. If we don't pay, we don't stay. You can go to our website, The Narrow Path, and click on the link about donations, and you can figure out how to help us out. That's thenarrowpath.com.
Hello, good morning. We're glad you could be here today to listen to the great answers that Steve Gregg gives to your very insightful questions. This is a ministry that helps people with some of the most fundamental aspects of their faith, and it provides a great service. If you would like to be able to, as Steve says, pay those radio bills, then we're asking you to go to Steve's website, thenarrowpath.com. And that website is very well set up. It's very easy to navigate. You can give, and you can also download fantastic resources all for free. And that's why it's so important to give to The Narrow Path, because they don't sell anything. They don't raise funds any other way but accept donations to help keep them on the air. If you need additional information on how to be able to give to Steve, you don't want to do it online, then do call us here at KBright. We'll be happy to help with that at 800-227-2337. Otherwise, go to thenarrowpath.com. The views and opinions on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Stay with us for Joyce Meyer next on KBright.
The Bottom Line's Roger Marsh.
God bless the folks in North Dakota for wanting to ban all abortions after you can hear a fetal heartbeat. America is not there yet. It's naive of us to think that we can just take to the streets and say, it's wrong to kill a child, that's the end of the conversation. Well, you're right. It's wrong to kill a child, that's the beginning of the conversation.
Discerning Talk Radio, The Bottom Line. Weekdays at 3 on AM 740. KBright, strengthening the local body of Christ.
KBRT at KBRT HD Costa Mesa and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled 9 Attitudes That Keep You Happy. Think back over the years and remember some of the major events that occurred. Are you remembering good times or bad? How did you respond in those moments? Generally, in good times, the response is well. But in bad, your attitude tends to be negative. It's amazing, though, how much your attitude can affect a situation. Today, Joyce will be teaching from Matthew chapter 5 on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Through it, you'll hear some of the different attitudes of the heart that Jesus desires you to have. Allow yourself to be open and see what attitudes you can change in your own heart. Now here's Joyce with today's teaching, 9 Attitudes That Keep You Happy.
I tell this every once in a while, but it's in my heart again this morning, so here it comes. I met a woman in a Starbucks coffee shop. She recognized me from TV, and she started to tell me about what a mess her life had been. And she said, I tell you, she said, life has just thrown me under the bus. And I said, you know what? It did the same thing to me, but I decided to drive the bus. Now, you see, she didn't understand what I'm trying to tell you today. She was going to spend the rest of her life under the bus. And she was going to tell everybody about it. And she was going to feel very sorry for herself because she was under the bus. And never once did it occur to her to crawl out from under the bus and get in the driver's seat and drive it and drive it around and pick up all kinds of other people that were hurting because they were under the bus. You know, often we ask, why do bad things happen to good people? But you know what? That's really a wrong question. And anytime you ask a wrong question, you're going to get no answer. We should ask, what happens to good people when bad things happen to them? What happens to good people when bad things happen to them?